Penny Stewart, in this case, the plaintiff in the underlying case, the appellate in this case. Judges, this is, you know, like every retaliation case, it's a shoot the messenger case. It's a timeline case. It has to do with, you know, it's very important when things happen and when things didn't happen. Your Honors, the court made lots of errors in the ruling, and I would just segment it in three areas. Overemphasis of defendant's position in the what I guess we call the pre-protected activity counseling, to the extent there was any counseling or discipline of my client prior to her protected activity. The court built that up and seemed to overemphasize defendant's position on that and didn't even mention our evidence on that. Just to kind of highlight some of that, judges. My client's supervisor admitted that there was a verbal warning, a document that wasn't given to her, about an incident on one of the rigs that she worked on. She was moved to the BP Atlantic rig, the Atlantis rig. The Atlantis rig is the most important rig that Sodexo does catering with. It's the jewel of the Gulf, is what they consider the jewel of the Gulf. It's where you would send your best people. And so they considered this move, and her supervisor admitted that the move was virtually a promotion, a lateral move. So whatever this verbal counseling, which she wasn't given, they just had a discussion about how to handle, you know, her subordinates. It was not evidence of severe problems with people not following chains of command and anything like that. It was simply a verbal warning, and my client was virtually promoted. The trial court did not even observe that evidence, didn't even bring it up, much less give it proper weighting under Rule 56. If you simply give some weighting to that testimony, then you cannot conclude that my client had significant discipline prior to protected activity. The next area I'd like to cover is protected activity. When did it happen, and whether it happened? There's two EEOC charges. The court had several comments in the opinion that seemed to it was a little bit complicated as to whether or not the court thought there was two EEOC charges or one EEOC charge. But the court did find that my client's complaint about discriminatory advice on December 10th, an email on December 10th, was the first instance of protected activity. Moving down, my client filed a charge of discrimination she was at the EEOC on May 5th. She was given a write-up, and I'm going to talk about this write-up. It's the only document I brought up here, and it's the termination write-up. This write-up was given to her first on May 9th and then given to her again on May 18th. The charge, the May 15th charge, was mailed to the EEOC on May 11th. Now, I believe the first time defendant brought up the issue of whether or not Sodexo received that charge prior to the termination. Obviously, I'm talking about this for the suspicious timing inference. Whether or not she received this prior to her termination, did not bring that up in the summary judgment record. Sodexo didn't argue that below. And so, court judges, I would just argue that it's waived. That particular issue is waived, but I did brief it for the court. And you know, there's extensive law on when documents received, either plaintiff's documents or defendant's documents, are received and by the EEOC. And even if you give them 3 days, most of our case law says that when a charge is mailed, it is received in 3 days, whether it's by a right to sue letter to the plaintiff or whether it's a charge that the plaintiff mailed to the defendant. So this time, the EEOC mailed it on May 15th. So it can't be questioned that the charge was either received the next day because their office is across the street, or that would be on May 12th. Remember, she was terminated on May 18th. Or it's on May 16th, if you give them 3 days or 2 days for a weekend. And so by all the case law that controls on when documents are received by the EEOC, defendant had to have, at least defendant's counsel, and I'll brief this for you, Your Honors, received the charge or was mailed to defense counsel on May 5th, May 11th. A little complicated with these dates. So clearly we had a charge that was within days of the termination. And that's what the record shows. And if it's anything else, it's an issue of material fact. The court failed to really clarify which one of these charges she was considering. But I believe she appeared to, Judge Mazza, I believe, appeared to accept the fact that there was one EEOC charge, the May 5th charge, but she didn't accept the fact that it had been received by Sodexo prior to the termination, which, of course, is a very important issue to suspicious timing. So, Your Honor, there's significant evidence that all the protected activity that's needed under Title VII was done. And there were two EEOC charges, one EEOC charge before and one after. The court entered an EEOC charge showing exhaustion on August 4, 2012. So it comes down to how the court dismissed the case by taking, overemphasizing the pre-protected activity counseling, and then going to the section where the court analyzed the causal link evidence. And basically, each element, this is the primary document that terminated the plaintiff. It's record document 1435 and 36. Every assertion here are the reasons for the termination. Every one of these assertions, the Donald Murphy incident, each assertion of misconduct or deficient performance, I have evidence. By the way, all of the evidence in this case that we presented to you has been from the defendant's witnesses on cross-examination and from the defendant's documents. In this case, 98% of the evidence is from the defendant's employers and the defendant's documents. Less than 1% of the evidence is from Ms. Stewart.
Well, let's stop right there.
Yeah.
Let's assume that the district court erred in holding that she failed to make a prima facie case. And we will grant that she made, arguendo, that she made a prima facie case. This 98% of the evidence shows makes a case for a non-discriminatory explanation of the employer's activity. I don't see anything rebutting that.
Your Honor, you're saying that you don't see any evidence rebutting their reason for the termination?
Their response on the...
Are you talking about in the judge's opinion or in the briefing?
In the record.
Well, let me go over it with you, Your Honor, because there's significant evidence that the reason stated for the termination were either false, outright false, or grossly unfair. It's stated here that there's no evidence that Donald Murphy acted in a threatening or inappropriate manner. If you look at the record says that he stood like this with his hands down like this. One person interpreted it as...
I'm not talking about her prima facie case.
Okay.
I'm talking about the employer's rebuttal of a non-discriminatory reason for termination. And there's plenty of evidence there, but what I don't see is anything that rebuts that non-discriminatory reason.
Well, Judge, I understood from the courts, from the case and from the briefing and so forth, that the defendant was alleging that the allegations in this exhibit, this final warning, were the reasons for the termination, the things summarized in this final warning. And, they allege that she was terminated because she didn't follow the chain of command.
Violated the chain of command by involving BP.
That's not true, Judge. The evidence, the record shows that she followed the workplace violence policy. She had two guys threatening to hit each other, and then one guy putting white supremacist symbols the weekend or the next hitch after that incident where they were threatening each other. And when they came back from the hitch, the white guy started putting white supremacist symbols all over the kitchen. My client had experience with that as a caterer in the Armory and seeing lots of violence caused by that. She thought they were going to fight. So she, as per the workplace violence policy, it says if imminent violence or violence is indicating, indicated, and I can read it to you, Judge. It says that you should bring it to your manager, bring it to HR, or security on premises. Security on premises, Jeff Powell, the BP representative on the site, said that security on premises was his people. Obviously, the caterer isn't security on premises. Security on premises is him and is BP personnel. So when she saw it in a fight happening, she brought it directly. There was no breakdown on the chain of command. With the evidence, much less considering it in the light most favorable to the plaintiff, if you just give it basic, weight without, every justifiable inference she could have, that's one example, Judge. Another example is your suspicions that Donald Murphy had stolen or abused drugs were also incorrect and refuted by drug testing results.
Now you're leaving Flanagan and Hayes.
When I was looking at Donald Murphy on the first page, Judge, yep, it said there was no evidence.
Where she went to BP was...
Oh, I'm sorry. You're right, Judge. Yeah, I jumped on you. I was leaving that section. And so that particular allocation that there was a problem with chain of command was made having to do with the Donald Murphy Hayes incident, and that's what we were just talking about.
And she went to BP instead of her own human resources department.
Well, because of the imminent violence.
That's what the employer said as a non-discriminatory reason, and I don't see any rebuttal of that.
You know, and she followed their policy, their chain of command policy on workplace violence. She followed their written policy. That's uncontestable.
How did she follow it by going to BP?
Because BP is the policy is if there's violence going to happen.
Policy is to go to human resources.
It's to go to human resource or the customer or the security on premises, which is BP, the customer. So he did it. She did that. It's just we have evidence there that she did follow the policy. So the statement is merely incorrect. The statement that she didn't follow the chain of command on the Hayes Flanagan is incorrect by their own admission, by their own policy. Your Honor,
let me ask you this, because I think you're going to run out of time given the number of issues that are here. Just tell me succinctly what the summary judgment record consists of. I assume it's depositions and so on and so forth, and you just spoke to 90%, but I mean, just kind of bullet point for me what the summary judgment record is. There a deposition of your client?
Yes, Judge.
All right, and what other depositions?
Well, we have the deposition of the client. We have the deposition of the HR person. We have the deposition of the HR person's supervisor, Woodworth. We have the deposition of Powell, the BP person. We have the deposition of...
So all the pertinent...
Everyone, Judge.
...employer people mentioned, those depositions are part of the summary judgment record?
Yes, Judge.
All right. From the plaintiff's side, which is not to say that your evidence doesn't come from that, in addition to your client, is someone else who's not on the employer's side in the list of depositions?
No, you mean on the plaintiff's side? No, Judge.
Yeah, okay.
Every deposition, that's the way it is in this area.
No, I'm just
We get all our proof from the defendant's lawyer.
Sense of the summary judgment, because part of the argument you're making is that the district court improvidently poured you out, and you're arguing implicitly that I guess that there are genuine issues of material fact. Is that what you're arguing?
Oh, yes, Judge.
All right, so I was just trying to get a sense of what the summary judgment record consists of, well, vis-a-vis, you know, who was deposed, et cetera, so that when we look at it, we know sort of what to look at. But, I mean, you've given me kind of the rundown. So, really, I take it there's nobody left to be deposed.
That's right.
In terms of this case. I mean, the record is complete, I guess.
It is complete, and as I've outlined in the briefing, every issue that they brought up against her is evidence from their own documents and their own witnesses that shows issues on each fact, issues of material fact on each alleged deficient.
You say the district court, I mean, as Judge Winters said, assuming that we disagree that there was no prima facie case,
yeah.
So assuming you've got one, you say that the district court did not construe the summary judgment record in a light most favorable to you as the non-movement.
Yes, Judge.
Is that the core of your argument?
That is the core of the argument, that the judge ignored evidence, and then when she cited evidence, the court failed to properly weight the evidence under Rule 56.
Okay. All right. You've got a red light. I just wanted to lead you to get you to that point that we've got the sense of your argument. I mean, you've reserved time for rebuttal.
Yes.
To go back through, but I wanted to make sure at least I understood the gravamen of your of the argument you're making mm-hmm. to us. All right, let's hear from Sedesco, and you have rebuttal time to come back up.
Yes, sir.
All right, Ms. Arrett. Got a full summary judgment record. I mean, why not try the doggone case? I mean, you depose everybody in the world. You can sit down, counsel.
Your Honor.
I mean, you got every deposition in the world of everybody. It's all tossed up. The complaints have been filed. The EEOC is investigated. I mean, yes, there's disagreement. Isn't that what trial's about? Why don't you try this case?
Because under the law, Your Honor, the plaintiff or the appellant here has not met either the prima facie case or demonstrated that there was pretext. This case has become—
The state of the law, and I have to tell you, it's been a long time since I've seen a case where a person failed to make the prima facie case, or B, the other side didn't concede it. I mean, most of these cases, the defense says, well, we'll assume, arguendo, there is a prima facie case. Let's move to the next step. Or, you know, the prima facie case is made. I mean, I'm speaking only for myself, but it's been a long time since I've seen a case where the first issue turns on that there's no prima facie case, particularly given as much here. So usually that's not the battlefront. It's usually not on it. The appellee says we'll concede for the sake of argument that there was a prima facie case, but here's our non-pretextual reason for why we discharged this person. This is why we ought to win. So why is the battlefront here over the prima facie case?
Your Honor, and I agree with you. I've been doing labor and employment law for nearly 30 years, and often we do concede that, but in here, And I'm a very visual learner, so I apologize for my little pictures here, but I drew them at 3 in the morning with stick men, so I assure you this is a better rendition. But there are hurdles.
Like you got a lot of time invested, so I want to leave it up here on the bench. I'm going to make sure I take it with me.
Post it on the wall. It's so beautiful. Actually, it's the work of someone more talented than me. My stick figures, in fact, they're drawn on the back of something in here, show the same thing, really, which is just that there are hurdles that are required, that the appellant is required to get over to meet a prima facie case on either Title VII retaliation or 1981 retaliation. Frankly, the last block before the blue block before the finish line on both is the only thing that's not part of the prima facie case. Judges, this case has been a whack-a-mole game. The facts have killed one claim, and most prominently when I took Ms. Stewart's deposition. Her testimony basically killed her claims, and then other ones have popped up since then. This case began as a very straightforward gender discrimination and retaliation claim. Her only EEOC charge claims that she was discriminated against based on gender because she was paid less than another fella. Her federal court complaint, and I always tell lawyers who work with me, read the complaint, read it again, then read it again in the middle of the case, read it again at the end of the case, read it again before you try your case. Because in this case, if you go back to that piece of paper, it was premised on this December 10, 2010 email that complained about one single comment she claimed was discriminatory based on her gender. There was absolutely no allegation in the complaint of retaliation because of a race complaint. None. Never been amended. That complaint's never been amended. All the allegations focus on her immediate supervisor, Crystal Smith. And noticeably, this whole Devin and Rance drama is nowhere, is only mentioned to demonstrate that Crystal Smith supposedly didn't support her. She concluded, and this is important, in her complaint that she was terminated in retaliation for complaining about gender discrimination and for filing a charge. No race discrimination. Since then, the appellant's attorney has crafted a story in which Stewart felt personally harassed.
Since then, do you mean since the summary judgment?
Yes, Your Honor. And in fact, it was even a moving target, that same whack-a-mole game, after the summary judgment papers were filed, because it wasn't until we were in Judge Malazzo's chambers for the pretrial conference that the counsel first brought up that another charge was filed. It wasn't in any of the summary judgment pleadings even. So this, again, whack-a-mole game. In the complaint, she alleges that she, one of the things that she says was discriminatory against her based on her gender was that she was sent to 4 days of training concerning after the issues that happened on her, on the Mad Dog. That was the issue that that one of the employees complained about her inappropriate comments, Mr. Chenoweth. So she went to, she was sent to this training. She claims that was discriminatory. What did the training do? It's discriminatory to her that the training gave her training on leadership, harassment, preventing workplace harassment, providing constructive feedback, and then an overview of this very vessel she was going to get transferred for onto, the Atlantis. She was given that training to give her a fresh start, which you'll see that recurring theme, that she's continuously counseled about these same issues, her failure to follow the chain of command, consistent failure to involve HR and her supervisors before going to the client, and frankly, disrespecting her supervisees because she made assumptions about what they did, meant, thought, without even speaking with them in certain instances, and we'll talk about that. So, first of all, let's talk about the legal argument. Frankly, there was not much in the way of legal argument in appellant's brief. There were a lot of unsubstantiated inferences and conclusions that, frankly, were huge leaps of faith. One in particular, counsel said Woodruff, who was the HR director, admitted Flanagan's writing of the Celtic cross symbols all over the workplace was an escalation of the prior Hitch's threats of violence. That's in his brief at page 9. Woodruff testified, question, did you understand it was an escalation to potential violence? Answer, not necessarily. That's record 1216. Okay, so let's get to these lovely non-stick figure drawings. And looking at Title VII, number one, that claim, and I'm gonna hold off the race issue until we get to 1981, but frankly, the hurdler falls even on exhaustion with respect to race on the Title VII claim, because Ms. Stewart never filed an EEOC charge with respect to race. There was a charge that, as I said, came up in the pretrial conference, but frankly, I believe there's no credible evidence that that's in the record. The EEOC, Keith Hill, from the EEOC, did a statement saying that it wasn't in the record. But regardless, even if you assume it made its way to the record, the EEOC never issued a right to sue on that. So the race claim fails. It's not exhausted under Title VII. The gender claim, there's no right to sue on retaliatory discharge. The only claim she exhausted under gender was with respect to this unequal pay issue about the fella that Mr. Leo Shanks, who she says was paid more than her. There's no exhaustion of a retaliatory discharge issue. So then we get to...
Would you tell us if there's anything in the record that constitutes plaintiff's rebuttal of the non-discriminatory explanation given by your client?
I don't think there is anything. That's a great question, Your Honor. I don't think there's anything in the record that demonstrates pretext at all. In fact, quite to the contrary. There's the only evidence in the record is that she was counseled repeatedly for the same issues.
Well, this was moot. This was summary judgment, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Can't affirm on any basis we see.
That's absolutely correct, Your Honor.
And if grant that for argument that she made a prima facie case even on one issue.
That's right.
We have the non-discriminatory, non-prejudicial explanation of your client, and no contest or rebuttal of that. Doesn't that end the case?
It absolutely does, Your Honor. And I do think the district court was absolutely correct in its finding on the prima facie case with respect to not protected activity. I will absolutely grant that an EEOC charge and certainly a notice of charge is protected activity. But frankly, the notice, all it did is have a box checked in the box of gender and then retaliation. That's all Sodexo received in February of 2011. And the charge was not received until after the counseling document in May, on May the 9th, in which the decision had already been made and, in fact, was conveyed to Ms. Stewart prior to Sodexo even receiving the charge and knowing of her allegations, which, remember, at that time were only gender discrimination because of a pay issue and unstated retaliation. So that was the only thing. In fact, she hadn't been terminated, so that clearly wasn't included. In fact, was never terminated.
On the pretext issue, what about plaintiff counsel's argument? Because one of your justifications is that she violated chain of command by going to BP, and he says, no, the policy actually says you can go to the on-site safety folks. What?
Yeah. Yes, Your Honor. In fact, I think that whole issue about workplace violence is a red herring, because the workplace violence policy does not say go to BP. It says go to security on board, and every witness testified that there was no security on board. BP does not equal security, and even the BP fella testified about that. In fact, the BP guy said it was not conveyed to me at all that anyone felt fear of violence. She went to the BP fella and said, you know, there's a personal issue between these two guys. There was this symbol, the Celtic cross found. I looked it up. It might be a racial symbol. And so what did the BP guy say? What, frankly, I would have said was, did you talk to the guy who put the symbol up there and ask him what it meant? Did you talk to anybody and find out whether or not they felt discriminated against? Because no one complained about that. She just found it. And indeed, she found it on the 19th of April. She didn't report it until the 24th of April. So if she felt a fear of violence, then why did she wait 5 days to report it to the BP guy? But the problem that Sodexo has is, number one, as you all know, in dealing with employment cases, is Sodexo's under a duty to take prompt remedial action. And so it's got to take action when its supervisor knows something. There's an agency responsibility. It's as if Sodexo, the big Sodexo, knows about it. So Penny Stewart knows something about it. And if she doesn't tell HR, she's stopping up the works, essentially, because she's not allowing the company to engage in proper remedial response. And so getting a client involved in HR issues that, you know, obviously we have a client relationship with and we don't want them mired in all of our issues, but we want her to come tell HR and the supervisors that she reports to about those issues. So I don't think that, back to the charts, I don't think that that she's met the protected activity responsibility in either the Title VII or the 1981 claim with respect to the central issue on the Title VII, which was her email, because I don't think that one single comment by another African-American female, when she wasn't even the one who brought up the gender issue, it was the appellant, could reasonably, objectively, or subjectively, she said, that it felt discriminatory against her. But I don't think under an objective standard that would rise to the level of a violation of Title VII. And then under the 1981 claim, I don't think the Devon and Rance issue rises to the level of a violation under 1981, because again, it's not an objectively reasonable belief. It's an isolated incident. She wanted to make it seem like it happened on March 31 all the way to April 23rd. March 31 was the tell old boy I left some beans comment, and then the slap the white off your face comment. That was the only thing that happened on March 31. And then nothing happens until April 23rd, when she reports that she found the marking on the food that was the D for Devon with the Celtic cross. So there was not a continuing pattern of harassment. It was an isolated incident. Indeed, she was acting as a manager, and I think this circuit has been very adamantly enforced the manager's rule. If I get to the right page, I can tell you.
What about this, complaint she had about Flanagan drawing the crosses on the food products? She alleged that was aimed at her as, you know, racial harassment?
No, Your Honor. She actually, that was never an allegation that it was aimed at her. I think that she felt that it was a continuation of the Devon and Rance comment that had happened on March the 31st. She never alleged it was aimed at her. She only testified that she had a prior experience which made her feel personally offended when she saw it. She ended up determining, she saw the wrapped product and looked it up on the internet to see what it meant. And she said she saw something that said, indeed.
Well, that was in connection with the Flanagan and Hayes company.
That's what, yes, Your Honor.
Not at her.
That was all the same issue, Your Honor. There was one Flanagan and Hayes comment back and forth that happened on March 31. And then on April 23rd, she goes in the freezer and sees the wrapping. So really, they're not connected by most people's standards, but she connected them and made that an issue that she then escalated to the BP guy, Kevin Powell. So I think in that, there's no question though, that she was definitely acting within her role as manager. She never stepped out of that role, which the Fifth Circuit applies very rigorously, that she didn't engage in any activity that was adverse to Sodexo's interests, in that she felt she was enforcing, and she testified that she was enforcing Sodexo's policy. She also testified that she felt it was a personal issue between those two fellows that she resolved. So I don't think by any objective standard she was engaging or asserting any protected rights there. I think it's also important to note that with respect to the adverse action, she in fact testified there was no termination, and she admitted that in her deposition. Her removal from the Atlantis was consistent with, it had happened with her in the past. She had been removed from another facility because of similar activities. Indeed, when she was first hired, she had a four-month hiatus before she began working. She had a several-week hiatus when she was engaging in the training and then hadn't been reassigned yet. And she testified in her deposition, importantly, that she didn't accept the assignments that were given to her after that because for two reasons. One was that she felt it was retaliatory against her based on her gender, but the other two reasons were that she felt there were too many POBs on the new vessel, was just people on board. It was a bigger vessel. She didn't want that. And it was further from her home than she wanted. And that's why she didn't accept it. Right. Can I answer any other questions?
Nope. I think we have your argument. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much.
There are 5 minutes for rebuttal.
First, just let me say that what opposing counsel was saying about when Ms. Stewart, the appellant, reported the issue, she did report it to management and she did report it to HR the very day she brought it to the alternative place on the handbook to the security on board.
I'm going to stop you so maybe we get the best use of your time. All right, assuming you got a prima facie case, which case has more potency? Is it your racial discrimination claim, and did you in fact make one such that you passed these hurdles the council officer says you didn't? Is it the gender discrimination claim? I mean, which is the claim you're trying to move forward? Both? Is one of them stronger than the other? Because we've got this record. I mean, we're not going to make it in 4 minutes to go through what all you say is there.
Right.
So you really need to try to convince us that the district court did not err, frankly, in pouring you out on the dismissal. So let's start with the race claim. What's your best evidence here that you've got a viable race claim?
We're not really pushing, and I thought I made that clear with the court, we're not pushing a race claim. We're pushing retaliatory termination.
All right, then you answer that for me.
Yes, Judge.
I just want to telegraph to you, nothing's clear, okay?
Yes,
all right, so we're clear now. All right, now, retaliation, that's what you're moving on?
Yes, Judge.
All right, why? I mean, tell me that.
Well, we're moving on retaliation because everything that they asserted against her to justify the termination, each component, each allegation of misconduct or deficient performance, I have evidence that counteracts it, even if you don't give it extra consideration or extra justification, you know, based on Rule 56. But especially if you give it justification, every point I have submitted evidence that is enough to show an issue of material fact on each of those points justifying the termination. I can read them off to you right now if you want me to.
No, I don't want you to do that yet. All right, now what? So retaliation is what you're really driving forward.
Right, and we have retaliation under both Title VII and retaliation under 1981.
Retaliation for what?
Retaliation for reporting, for filing an EEOC charge under Title VII, Judge, filing her first written complaint to the company, December 10th, email was protected activities found by the court, her EEOC charge dated May 5th.
What do you do with the non-discriminatory response from the employer.
Well, I've deconstructed the entire response, Judge. Everything they say that justifies termination, I've submitted to you evidence, significant evidence, that shows it's either blatantly untrue. Some of the allegations here are untrue within on their face.
Which ones?
While Devin Flanagan, I'm looking in the Devin Flanagan Hayes under, it's under record 1435. It's the term the write up. While Devin Flanagan's use of the term "oh boy" and Rance Hayes' statement to Devin that he would slap the white off his face were not appropriate. We are not, you know, and not condoned in any manner. There is absolutely no evidence. The employees were involved in any conflict at the time the statements were made. No evidence.
Then why did she report it?
Well, she had to report it. It was misconduct, serious misconduct.
There was no evidence.
Oh, no, no, no. This is the defendant. I'm sorry, Judge. This is Sodexo saying to my client, there was no evidence that there was any indication that there was violence when one of the guys threatened to hit the other guy. Pardon?
Violence. But then what they complained of, and what their reason was, is that she went to BP.
Well, I explained, Judge, that the policy, their written workplace violence policy, gives her the option to go to the security on plant premise.
BP didn't have any security.
Yes, they did, Judge. Powell admitted that his people were the offices. What counsel said, we have evidence otherwise. Every point she said, we have evidence otherwise. She did follow, I have extensive briefing on that, she followed the chain of command. And even Powell admitted she followed the chain. If Powell's at another rig right now, which Sodexo is a caterer, and almost the exactly same thing happened there, and he sent them home. Sodexo wanted the employees that were threatening each other sent home, and their people were not, the supervisor was not terminated. It was right for that manager to bring a violence issue to another rig where there wasn't EEOC charges and, you know, retaliatory motive. And so,
do you have a viable gender claim? You got a gender difference?
No, Judge. It is purely retaliatory termination.
The retaliation is the claim.
Yes, Judge.
Okay. That's the claim.
That is the claim, Judge. Retaliatory termination.
We look at the summary judgment record. That's really the evidence that we should be honing in on in terms of whether or not, A, you've touched the bases on it.
Yeah.
B, whether there's a genuine issue of material fact, if you get past that.
Yes.
Is that the core of it?
That is the core, Judge.
Okay. So I want to be clear.
And so what we're doing is
retaliation for making what you claim are allegations about racial issues and gender issues, right? I mean, that's the protected activity.
Well, the protected activity, she complained about differences in pay based on gender. And she did complete the charge. She did have a charge go in before. Amended charge went in before the right to sue issue was done. It was in the record. Counsel indicated it just came from Judge Malazzo allowed me to put it in the record because it was in the record. We have 300 pages of briefing on whether or not you should consider that charge. So I'll refer you to it if you'd like to read that briefing. It's 662 and through 1936.
You've had your shot. We're just trying to make sure that we're not wandering down paths that we need not go, and to understand as best we can, you know, that which you are, you know, really urging is the claim that we ought to look at. But we've got the briefing, and now we have the argument from both sides, so we'll deem the case submitted. Thank counsel for presenting the case. We'll figure it out, and in due course, we'll rule on it. That completes the cases that we